Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Pulse, where we talk to digital health experts, enthusiasts, entrepreneurs from all over the world, disrupting healthcare one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Maida Afan, and I'm really excited about talking to our guests. But just before that, a quick reminder to like our LinkedIn page, subscribe to our YouTube channels, and we are also present on 6 different podcast channels, including Spotify and Google Podcasts. So without further delay, today we have with us Lauren Howard, a digital health strategist, an entrepreneur, CEO, and founder of L2 Consulting, a firm that specializes in startup advisory in telehealth, mental health, and other digital health spaces. Welcome to the podcast, Lauren.
Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
So Lauren, I want to know how your journey into entrepreneurship started. Tell me a little bit about your background. And interestingly enough, I came across one of your recent LinkedIn posts in which you had described a situation. It was more like a conversation you were having with yourself and about resigning actually from a job. And so I'm wondering if that was the turning point for you into your journey into entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I think so. So I've always had kind of side businesses and little things that I've tried. It's just always been the way my brain works, is like turning things into businesses. I don't necessarily recommend it. It takes up a lot of your brain space. But that's always been my inclination. And I've always just functioned better in an environment where I kind of, this sounds terrible, but where I create the rules. And so that's always been my inclination. But when I was younger, I always felt like I needed to have a full-time job to obviously to, you know, support our family and things like that. So, I had, you know, I always held a full-time job at the same time as having some other, projects going on. But I will say that, moving into the direction of entrepreneurship full-time was terrifying, because Not because of actually my own belief in my capability to do it, because I really did think I could do it, but just more because everybody tells you it's impossible. Everybody in your universe, you know, says, well, you need a full-time job, you have kids to feed. And my experience has been that it's pretty much the same thing. It's a little bit harder in that the pressure is all on you, but lots of people with full-time jobs right now will tell you that that's not guaranteed either. Yeah. So yeah, I think that was kind of part of the push toward it. And then just also like being exhausted and wanting to be able to do things at my own pace, whether that was my typical frenetic Energizer Bunny pace or taking more time than I typically have. So yeah.
Yeah, no, that sounds awesome. So tell me a little bit about L2. And I know there has a different vertical. So just briefly about what L2 Consulting is and what you do.
Yeah. The parent company is called L2. It's where all of my brands roll up to. It's a little confusing because I do have a number of different verticals that are not terribly overlapping, but they all come from the same intention, which is figure out how to support humans. And so being in the healthcare space, obviously there's all sorts of opportunities to support humans and improve outcomes and focus on human-centered everything. So I have, you know, kind of accidentally over time, I built this consulting company. It was not really the plan. I don't know what the plan was, but over time I had a lot of digital health organizations and telehealth organizations come to me and say, hey, could you help us look at our wireframes? Could you explain to us how you would handle this situation? Things like that. And that turned into a company after a couple of months. It wasn't intentional. I'm not complaining. Very happy with it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't intentional. So through that process, and really the process that brought me a lot of that business that has turned into my consulting company, I had started posting on LinkedIn and posting pretty regularly about just the things that I had experienced in the workplace and things that I had experienced throughout my entire career and things that I had kind of done to myself just by not really understanding like intrinsic human value. I understood everybody else's value. I didn't understand my own value. Mm-hmm. And that turned into the communities that I now run, because what I thought I was saying something that was unique to me. And in reality, the feedback that I got was everybody was like, thank you for saying this, because this is my experience as well.
Yeah.
And so I started turning them into, you know, posts and courses, and that eventually emerged as my first community, which is a Slack-based community for women. And now we run three different communities for three very different populations, all based on the same thing. Like, sitting alone at your work from home office is not a great way to live your life. Or even if it is, you still need access to a community. Community makes things better. I'm a horrifically introverted person who never likes to leave this room.
Right.
I am a digital first communicator, but I'm able to get all of that, you know, real community sense from those as well. So we have the healthcare consulting organization. We have the communities, which are also part of it. And then we also have a partnership with another organization that is an actual operating 50 state medical practice. So we can provide both the digital health solutions and the actual clinical solutions. And that was like a game changer for whatever this was we wanted to build. And so that has turned into some actual telehealth brands. Mm-hmm. And basically, I'm just living out my dream. It's sort of boiled
fantastic.
Down to.
Fantastic. I think that, you know, being a woman in this space, which I'll get into more a little later, because that is just a topic that we have to talk about, right? Like, we cannot talk about it. So I see that, you know, a lot of your focus, again, is on digital health, telehealth, and particularly mental telehealth startups. And I've also seen you talking about clinicians being at the forefront of these startups, you know, being more involved in product development, in policy and decision making, in marketing. And you're not a clinician yourself, but you advocate for it. And I wanted to know, you know, why do you think it's important for clinicians to be involved in these processes?
I think it's vital. And I think we've seen that by decision making in the marketplace in the last several months by some of these large, you know, very large, well-funded companies. Clinicians are not necessarily good business people. And so when you put them in a room with business people, the business people kind of run the other way because they're not talking about revenue generating things. They're talking about outcomes generating things. And the two things may not be, you know, the two things are incongruous in a lot of cases. There has to be a medium between that. And sometimes it's just a very deliberate choice. And it's a choice my partner and I make all the time, which is that, like, sometimes you just have to do what's right by the humans who are in front of you and the, like, hope it all comes out in the wash. And in my experience, it does. I mean, I've run a fair number of successful telehealth operations and they've all been successful. And so, but have they turned into billion-dollar unicorn companies? No, and they're not going to. And so there has to be space for clinicians to come to the table with the right thing to do for patients and find that space of what's left for what works for the business, but also what works from a clinical perspective.
Yeah.
Because when you treat, I've said this 1,000 times lately, and I think people are probably tired of hearing it, but when you treat healthcare, mental health especially, but only because I feel like that's more appropriate for the current climate, not appropriate, but like it applies more to what's happening in the digital health universe right now, mm-hmm. but in all spaces of healthcare. When you treat healthcare like a revenue driving experience that where you are going to pay back venture capitalists for their investments and you're going to do it quickly, usually the only way to get there is by doing things that other clinicians will not do. Usually because they're not ethical or not well, you know, don't have a lot of oversight or will eventually get them in trouble. And so if you don't have a clinician at the top or a compliance person or a legal person saying, don't do this, this is a bad idea.
Yeah.
And really focusing on clinician first and saying like, sure, this is going to make the company a lot of money, but it's going to cost a lot of clinicians their licenses. You end up in the situation that a lot of these companies are in now that people are actually paying attention. Like, you got a 2-year grace period because people were too busy dealing with the pandemic to pay attention to what you're doing. And now they're going to pay attention and we're seeing clawbacks. We're seeing regulatory action. We're seeing all sorts of things that people like me have been screaming, we're going to happen.
Yeah.
But because we got a grace period with gray area, people ignored it.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head with that. And And, you know, just again, the scope of digital health solutions and in the digital health market and the way that it's growing, and you can see the demand for mental health solutions, especially from both provider perspective and a patient perspective. And so where do you see telepsychiatry in particular going, or where do you see the future? Is it effective? Do we still have, you know, work to do in this space? What are some of the opportunity areas that you find in this space?
I think we always have work to do. Like, we're never going to get to a place where we've done all the work, because I think we're proving, well, we have proven, and pre-pandemic we have proven, that telemental health was as effective, if not sometimes more effective, than in-person treatment, especially for people who become dysregulated by leaving their own environment, people with high anxiety, people with PTSD who might be triggered by unfamiliar environments. There was already really good evidence that by keeping those people in their comfortable environments, their mental health outcomes were better through telehealth. In most other cases, they're pretty consistent. I've gotten to work with some pretty large substance use organizations who had to go fully digital during the pandemic. Or the beginning of the pandemic, who were able to track outcomes for that period. And after 3 to 4 months, the outcomes for residential treatment and fully remote treatment were exactly the same. And so, I think we've really proven that that model is good. Yeah. I think the biggest challenge we're going to have, and this is a challenge that exists across the digital health space, across telehealth, is that we cannot allow it, which we already are doing in some ways, and we have to get focused on. We cannot allow it to create two healthcare systems where if you have good commercial insurance or you have money, you can go get your telehealth session or get all of your mental health easily, and everybody else is forced to go sit in a waiting room at the community mental health center that's on a 6-month waiting list, and you have to go in person to get an appointment. And that's not a criticism of those centers. That's just the reality of, you know, these underfunded, high pressure environments.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's my biggest concern in pushing toward digital health. And it's something my partner and I are focused on all the time, is we can't end up with another situation where we have a healthcare system for people with means and a healthcare system for people without. And that will, you know, I think digital health and telehealth specifically have a huge opportunity to overcome that, but they also have a huge opportunity to further reinforce that. And we just have to be careful about that.
Yes. Yes. No, definitely. And as a startup consultant, I'm sure that you talk to startup founders all the time, especially in the mental health space and also telemedicine and other sectors in digital health. What are some of the most common mistakes that you see these startups doing? I mean, obviously, not everyone's going to be a success story. But again, your experience, what advice would you give them if someone is thinking to venture out into this space?
Yeah, absolutely. So this isn't even from a healthcare perspective. This is just, I work with a lot of startups and some of them aren't even in the healthcare space. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem I see is overexcited founder syndrome. That's what I call it. Maybe somebody else calls it that. I don't know. But it's where you see these really, really brilliant people who want to fix all the problems, and they come in with a very specific niche purpose, or maybe they don't. Sometimes they just come in with an idea. And all of a sudden, MVP becomes do all the things and show everybody all of the capabilities that we should have in 10 years. And what they're doing is overdeveloping a platform that cannot sustain growth because, one, they're pulling their developers in way too many ways or way too many directions. But also, every time you update something, you have to account for the features that you've already overbuilt. It makes it hard to market. It makes it hard to find your target client. It makes it hard to understand who your population is. And so having all of these great ideas is wonderful. Put them on a roadmap. Know you're going to get there. Focus on the thing that you can do well right now, because we're not in an environment where you're going to get hundreds of millions of dollars of VC capital anymore based on an idea and a fake valuation. Like, that's not going to happen anymore.
Yeah.
Find something you can do well. Do it well,
and keep it simple, right? And keep it simple. I think just simplification is something that, again, we have to focus on. Definitely. In healthcare, there's no plug and play. You have to sort of adjust to your client or to the requirements. But again, let's just keep it simple, and then work our way up from there. You know, I'm just going to switch topics here briefly, and I want to address this issue of digital divide and discrimination. And as a female in entrepreneurship, as women in STEM, as women in the corporate sector, you know, female or gender-based discrimination is evident in unequal opportunities and maternal and pregnancy discrimination and the gender pay gap. And I could, you know, the list goes on. And so this systemic discrimination extends into the digital health space and other emerging sectors like crypto. You don't see females investing in those areas as much as men do. And, you know, even though studies show that women are more willing to seek help for healthcare or remote care options or in mental health, fewer access points as compared to men to these resources. And this is where I think community building comes in. I really wanted to sort of pick your brain on that, because I know that you believe in a community. I know that you've built a community. How important is it to build a community, to improve access, to improve, you know, just to give that support and ultimately better patient outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think community is vital. And I think a lot of the, you know, I think a lot of the problems we're seeing from a global perspective now, from a kind of socio and like social problems and things like that, are coming from a long-term breakdown in community structure. I mean, there is a reason that people are responding so well to this random Slack channel that I give them access to, so that they can just show up and say whatever, you know, in a safe space, say whatever they're feeling. And it's usually just, you know, silly stuff like frustrations during the day, but why aren't they saying this to people standing next to them? And the answer is there's not a lot of people standing next to them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have never been an isolated species. That was never the plan. And 100 years ago, when you had a baby, you were surrounded by everybody in your family and the entire community, and everybody knew you were having a baby and they all showed up to help. And now you have a baby and they expect you to stay alone in your house for 3 months because you don't have an extended support system because you live far away, because we can do everything digitally now. And I'm saying this as a person who very much prefers to stay in my house alone for 3 months. Like, ask me the last time I left my house, I don't remember. Yeah. But that's not the way that that's not the way that humans are supposed to operate. And so I think the fact that, you know, I say this as a person who's enamored with digital health, I think the fact that we can do everything from a distance right now has created systems that reinforce poor access to care, because you don't have family around who are noticing that there's a problem, or you have less family, or you can communicate in ways where tone and inflection are not important, or not, you know, people can infer those things.
Yeah.
And so I think that really has change the way that we communicate. I think it's also in some ways made it easier, so that if you have the insight to know that something's not right, I can jump on my phone and get help. But we're talking about mental illness, where insight is not usually the thing that is in high supply.
Yeah.
And so it's not a surprise to me that people are desperate for community, because this digital world has in a lot of ways stripped that out and made it more possible to get away from a strong family unit, which really was your support system for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years.
And now it's random strangers, right?
Right. And now you have to go make mom friends, and that's terrifying.
No, absolutely. No, but then building a community is one thing, but building a successful community in which people really trust you, Lauren, I think that's really where the accomplishment lies. And so you're like juggling on so many fronts. I'm just wondering how you find the time to do it. And what are some tips for building a successful community?
Yeah, so I'm all smoke and mirrors. I'm supported by people who are way smarter than I am, who do all the hard work. And I like what I do. And so it makes it easier to spend a lot of time doing it. Do I spend the kind of hours working on these things that I did and in a kind of a past life where work was everything? No, I know where my limit is, and it slows me down sometimes, and that's fine. I like watching Bluey on the couch with my kids. Like, it's what I like to spend my time doing, but I like my work. I like what I do. I like the fact that if I get an idea, I can just go build it. And so that makes it easier. But can I do it without a crazy strong support system? And this goes back to kind of the last thing you were talking about. No, if I didn't have reliable childcare, and if I didn't have an assistant who reminds me when I forgot my head somewhere, and a partner who will push me back to center when we need to focus on something, and a husband who is super dad and does everything around our house, none of it would be possible. So I feel like there's probably this unrealistic persona out there that I'm this superwoman who can do everything, and only because I have tons and tons of help. I mean, my mom's two blocks away. My mother-in-law is five blocks away. I have my brother nearby. I have my husband. I have full-time childcare. I have children who, for whatever reason, like really enjoy this environment we built for them. So I don't feel too truly terrible about it.
Yeah.
I had to work a long time to build this environment that lets me be as engaged as I am. And so if you don't have those things, if you don't have full-time childcare and you have a full-time job and you haven't built for a lot of years to have the savings that allow this kind of, allow this kind of trajectory, that makes you completely normal. If I didn't have a whole team of people propping me up, none of this would be possible.
Right. No, I think, well, thank you for sharing that, first of all, because it's such a real view. I think everything on social media is just, it's just one angle of it. And then there's just everything else that goes on in the background. That's amazing. I just want to sort of also talk to you about your content creator journey on LinkedIn. And you have almost 25,000 followers on LinkedIn. And LinkedIn is not one of those platforms that, you know, is a platform of choice for a content creator. So how has your journey been on LinkedIn, and how do you really find the balance between professional and personal content creation on LinkedIn?
So it's a super good question, and it's something I think about a lot, because most of my professional content is fairly personal.
Yeah.
It's
inappropriate. Persona. That's what I'm saying.
It's inappropriate. Right. It's this persona I've kind of created over time. It wasn't intentional. My journey to content creation was one, like, rife with getting over myself, and this idea that people cared what I did. Yeah. I thought that people would think I was losing my mind for having something to say on LinkedIn. And I don't remember who said it to me, but very early on in the process, somebody basically said, like, nobody's paying attention to you. You're worried about what people will think. Yeah. Nobody thinks about you.
Yeah.
And it wasn't designed to be mean. It was designed to be freeing, and it absolutely was.
Yeah.
But I just started sharing. I needed a network. I didn't have a network. I'd been in a silo for 5 years building somebody else's company.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really have a network, and I wanted one. And I felt like
I bet it was cathartic as well, in a way.
Eventually it got there. But yes and no, because people come to me all the time and ask me how I can write so vulnerably when I, you know, talk about things I've experienced. And it doesn't feel that way to me, because usually when I'm writing about something that happened a long time ago that I've already done the work on and that I've disconnected from and have a different perspective on.
Right.
And so it just feels like I'm writing something that I have to say. It's not like I'm, you know, digging deep into my most vulnerable corners to share those things. And so it is easier for me probably than I think it would be for most, because I just talk about things I've disconnected from.
Yeah.
But by that same token, the process to getting here was saying something on LinkedIn that I thought was only me, people responding and saying, oh my gosh, I felt this too. And me realizing that there was this almost reality vacuum of people feeling like, and I was doing it to myself, I'm the only one who must be feeling this. And it hasn't been the case once.
Yeah.
And so I've been building for about a year. Like, the fact that anybody voluntarily follows me and like looks for my content blows my mind, because to me, it's just like the drivel that comes out of my mouth on a random Saturday afternoon. but it has truly built, when I say it's built a community, like I have hundreds of people now, literally hundreds that I could turn to and say, I need this. And they would turn around and get it for me. And I would do the same for them. Right. And then beyond that, I didn't go trying to build a business. I went trying to build a network because I didn't have a network. But I've now built a couple of businesses that I would not have at all in any way, shape, or form without this community that not only gave me the ideas, but supported me through building them.
Yeah.
And so it was just such a kind of a powerful transition that I didn't really even realize was happening. And so a year ago, had you told me that I would be a content creator somewhere and I would have any kind of following anywhere, I would be like, me? No, I'm just going to sit in this dark room by myself because I don't like people and I don't need people hearing what I'm thinking. And now I'm like, I have a thought. I'm going to share it with the entire world.
Exactly. And it's working out great. And we can see, and you know what I think? I think that Black women should not be four times more likely to die in childbirth than women in the wealthiest country who are watching or listening will get this reference. When you go to Lauren's LinkedIn page and read all her posts, because this is a constant in all of her posts. And, you know, I think it's so powerful. I think the impact that this statement creates is it just becomes etched in your subconscious because, especially for your followers, particularly for your followers, because they're the ones reading it. But it's also become an important brand differentiator for you. And so tell me a little bit about that. I think it's so fascinating. I think it's brilliant, the strategy and even the message more than anything. But what sparked this and why do you feel so strongly about it?
I don't remember. I know I very deliberately started doing it. I very deliberately started doing it after a post where I discussed it and I got a whole lot of feedback, mostly from women of color saying like, thank you for using your platform to talk about something that has really nothing to do with you. But the awareness of it came from, I had two very complicated pregnancies. We couldn't get pregnant to start with. And then both of them were severely premature. And I had all sorts of complications during both. And then not that long after my second daughter was born, a very good friend of mine had her third child and was hospitalized very briefly before for, you know, nondescript blood pressure issues. Nobody knew what was going on. And then was hospitalized three more times after he was born for what seemed to me to be things that should be like very clearly monitored in pregnancy. And I knew that there was this disparity, but I had never seen it in like living color in front of me.
Yeah.
And I realized that I had had similar issues and I was alive and going through it twice. If she had been through it twice, the chances of her living through it twice were way less than me. And so it just kind of made it all, and she's fine. She has a beautiful baby boy and they have their children and she's, you know, back to life now, not back to life, but yeah. Back to living regular life now. Yeah. He's a year old, everything's fine. I just remember going, how did this happen? And then remembering that there was this very, very terrifying statistic that kind of told me this had the potential to happen. And once I put all those pieces together, it was the best way I could come up with to describe why, you know, how we are not serving a huge portion of our population. And obviously I'm personally sensitive to maternal health. I've, you know, lived through those realities myself, yeah. But it's a illustration of the disparities in healthcare across the board. I mean, anybody who is not a 45-year-old white male gets, in some cases, or has the potential to get subpar treatment because our treatment models are built off of 45-year-old white males.
Yes.
And that's not okay.
Yeah.
So that's where it came from. And it's the area that gets me the most emotional, but like only by a little. If you know, there's all sorts of subjects we can talk about aligned with this that fire me up in no time, but it's all the same thing. People are being treated differently and we don't even realize it until we look at the numbers that show us that huge numbers of people are dying and it's not because they are not attentive to their healthcare. It is because our healthcare system is not attentive to them.
excellent. I couldn't have said it better. But the fact that you realize this and you're using your platform to just amplify this message is amazing. Lauren, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed
our conversation. I think the work that you're doing is fantastic.
Well, I really appreciate it. I don't do a whole lot of podcasts and even being on video because I'm a weird introvert, but this was lovely. I really appreciate it. And if I can ever do it again, let me know.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thank you. Thank you everyone for listening. Until next time, take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.